The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today it's time for Q&A with Layla, which means it's a chance for you to pose your questions to us collectively. Layla Mudin joins me today. She is Hoffman Center nutritionist. We work together on a daily basis helping patients, and today we're going to use a tandem approach to field your questions. Radio program at AOL.com is the place you send your questions to. And we reserve the right to answer whatever questions we want. If your question is too long or too circuitous or not of general interest, well, we might not read it. But the vast majority of questions get answered on Q&A with Layla. So, Layla, how you doing?
All right. How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks. So, before we get to our questions, I think one of the most remarkable stories of the week, I think there are two. You know, one is the finding that, and I think we've known this, that a very low-salt diet, this according to an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, may actually be harmful for you. You know, we base so many of our assumptions on the idea that, you know, how low can you go? Every different advocacy organization has a different sodium target, the FDA, and various governmental organizations set goals, and it actually turns out that if you were to comply with these goals, you might, according to a study in the New England Journal of Medicine, a big study, you might put yourself at higher risk.
That's true. Hyponatremia, low salt, isn't for everybody. And I think the mistake that was made, you know, in our governments, our local government and so forth, about curtailing salt has more to do with sodium itself in processed foods. That's really the culprit here. Because there's a whole lot of sodium. I'm not talking about a bag of chips or anything like that. I'm even talking about a supposed good quality whole grain bread will still contain a lot of sodium.
Yeah, it turns out I think that they came up with the idea that about 60% of the sodium that we consume is already in the food, so it's not coming from the salt shaker.
Right, exactly. So if you're eating a whole foods-based diet and you just use the salt shaker occasionally, the amount of salt is just fine. It's too much when we're overdoing processed food.
Right. And also, you know, I think you know from your nutritional counseling that there's no one-size-fits-all approach. There's some people who really have serious problems with sodium, and their blood pressure shoots up when they consume too much sodium, or they develop water retention. They need to curtail their sodium intake. And then there are other people who actually quite the opposite happens. They feel lousy. B, sometimes paradoxically, their blood pressure adjusts because when you consume very little sodium, your renin angiotensin system compensates for it. Your blood vessels clamp down and your blood pressure may go up.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And other people with, you know, adrenals, burnt out adrenals may need a little more salt than usual. People with mitral valve prolapse may need a little more salt.
Right. They're weak and woozy unless they consume adequate electrolytes.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's not forget, sodium is an electrolyte.
Yep.
Sodium, along with potassium, calcium, magnesium, is an electrolyte. We would not live without it. So.
Yeah, I mean, there were parts of Africa where they used to trade gold for salt, ounce for ounce. They'd say, oh, we don't need the shiny yellow stuff. It looks nice, but it's of no value. Just give us salt, because they were such salt-deprived areas of inland Africa.
Yeah.
So the other story that caught my eye, pretty remarkable one, I posted it on my Facebook page, and I talked about on last week's Intelligent Medicine, the broadcast that's on the radio. Headline, you may not be in charge of your cravings. Your microbes may have commandeered your brain.
Mm.
Well, that's a crazy story, because what they suggest in this story is, you know, it's kind of like, remember that movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And because what they did was they jumped into people's bodies and they hijacked people's brains. And so you had these zombie-like people walking around, but they were obedient to these aliens. In this story, it's almost like we have aliens living in our intestinal tracts, and they send subtle signals to our brain to make us eat wrong foods that actually are designed more to feed them than feed us.
Yeah.
You know, like high sugar
intake. Is that why this whole zombie culture is back on television? Maybe this is part of the reason.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Well, you know, a classic case of this, and we would consider this not new information, you and I, somebody with candida overgrowth in their GI tract is going to crave sugar more than the next person.
And, you know, I've always kind of remarked on, I thought, gee, how could it be? Because people say, oh my goodness, you know, when I have candida, I crave sugar more. And I thought, you know, that's kind of like a cop-out because, you know, it's up to you whether you consume sugar. But actually, some people devolve into a state where there's so much yeast overgrowth that it's almost like the yeast is overmastering their own willpower to feed itself. I mean, the yeast wants to, you know, it's a process of survival of the fittest. The yeast wants to survive too. So a very interesting theory, and it, you know, through various mechanisms, hijacking people's appetite, you know, these mechanisms in the brain that control appetite. Actually, there's a different model for this, and that's there's a bug called toxoplasmosis, which is a serious infection. And what it appears to do is something similar, is that in order to spread itself through the cat population, it's actually carried by mice and rats. And when a mouse is infected with toxoplasmosis, it renders the mouse more bold and less frightened when in the presence of cats. Usually mice and rats, you know, even if they smell.
Goodness.
Yeah, it actually makes them more vulnerable to cats, making cats eat them.
Oh, boy.
And so that's another example from nature of how the nervous system and brain can be commandeered by an internal organism to the advantage of the internal organism, because obviously it's not to the advantage of the mouse or the rat to see a cat and go, oh, yeah, hey, hi, cat, you know, no problem. Because they're going to die. But the toxoplasmosis is going to then infect the cat. And that's why humans who handle cat poop, especially pregnant women, have to watch out because they can get this terrible infection. So anyway, found it interesting. And, you know, who knows? I mean, there's so many reasons why people can't stop eating junk. You know, insulin resistance and, you know, serotonin in the brain and force of habit. But this may be one of the mechanisms, our internal microbiome, the organisms that inhabit our gut may crave those usually sugar-rich carbohydrate foods. Very cool.
Yeah, very, very cool. Fascinating.
So, we've got a bunch of questions.
Yep. Yeah, let me start with this one. It may sound similar to one we had before, but I think it's different. This comes from Maggie. Dr. Hoffman, not sure if I've ever heard you talk about alkaline water. It seems like there's great benefits on health by drinking alkaline water. Is it true? Is there any disadvantage by using alkaline water? I'm thinking to get a machine that can make alkaline water. It's about $4,000. Am I crazy?
Right.
Yes, you are crazy, and don't buy it.
Thank you. You know, there's this whole thing about this, you know, alkaline water. And, you know, there's so many ways that we affect our acid-base balance. One is, you know, just with oxygenating our tissue, you know, by breathing, by moving, by having blood circulate and oxygen go to our tissue. Then, yes, there's diet. But the acidity or alkalinity of our body is carefully regulated by internal systems and is not so much affected by whether we, you know, if we could, you know, one of the most alkaline things in the world is baking soda. But you can consume lots and lots of baking soda. And, you know, it's probably not going to make a big difference in your pH. It's carefully regulated. You know, conversely, you know, you can have sour lemonade or drink vinegar, and that's not going to necessarily make you that acidic. So
I don't think people realize that it is actually very tightly regulated, and if it was not, we would die.
Yep.
Just like we would die without sodium. Okay, I'm on a we would die thing here today. But alkaline water, if you want more alkalinity in your diet, drink lemon water. Eat more produce. That's fine.
Yeah. Let's go over it. You know, in general, the things that contribute to acidity, grains, starches, and sugars actually, while seemingly, you know, they seem not very acidic or tart tasting, they actually burn to an acidic composition of the body. Meat also, to a certain extent, but actually studies of cultures where they have a fairly high meat intake without a lot of sugar and carbohydrates, they have a relatively neutral acid-base balance. And, of course, plant foods, fruits, vegetables, for just the most part, those are the ones that are more alkaline in content.
Yeah. Nature set it up for us. We've got the alkalinity in the produce and the acidity in the meat. And by the way, fats are neutral.
Yeah.
People don't realize that fats are absolute, or fats or oils, all of that. But even a fattier piece of meat is going to be a little less acidic than a very, very, very lean piece of meat or something like that. So,
And, so, you know, the worst of all is probably, you know, like sugar, soft drinks, they're very, ultimately very acidic.
I mean, grains and dairy products, the newer foods of civilizations, are actually more acid-forming. So if we stick to our more, you know, Stone Age type of diet, we're better off. And there are disadvantages to becoming too alkaline.
Yes, there are. Yeah, and I think that the emphasis is on, you know, alkalinize, 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 and that solves some problems. But actually, people who are too alkaline may have a higher propensity to allergies. You know, they're very sensitive skin conditions.
So Maggie, don't spend $4,000 on getting a machine to make alkaline water. Just don't do it.
Send it to the Intelligent Medicine Foundation, which we're going to set up for study of acid alkaline. You know, science. No, actually, we don't. Please don't.
Okay.
I think, I'm thinking, I maybe, you know, I might be in the wrong business here. I think I need to be in the alkalinizing water purifier business. That
sounds
there
you
like
go.
That's a better business.
It's selling. All right. Our next question comes to us from Doug. Doug, I am. He says, I am a type 2 diabetic. Is there a green powder or capsule that you can suggest to boost my vegetable intake? Doug, why aren't you eating your vegetables?
You know, I have to say that, I agree with you, Layla, that the best thing to do, instead of having a dehydrated, you know, freeze-dried powder that contains some vegetable extract, the best thing to do is to consume fresh fruits and vegetables. I think you devitalize the fresh fruits and vegetables when you turn them into a concentrate, and you know, having them fresh is preferable. Having them cooked, you lose some of the vitality, but it also enables you, for example, to eat collard greens and kale, which are a little hard to chomp down on raw. But I have to say that, you know, I've seen a couple of scientific studies that look at the benefits of powdered fruits and vegetables, and the studies kind of go back and forth, but some of the studies do support the benefits of whatever it is that you get from those powdered fruits and vegetables. So, you know, that there might be a place for that for people who just really disdain fresh fruits and vegetables or who can't get them, or as kind of an insurance policy. You know, there's like these juice plus kinds of products, you know, that you mix in water or you can take in pills. And, you know, I there may be some benefit to that, especially for people who you know, eat poor diets. At least you're adding something.
Yeah. Well, my main concern for Doug is if he's a type 2 diabetic, having a green powder isn't going to fix his blood sugar issues.
Yeah.
He needs to be on a good diabetic diet, a low-carb diet, to take care of that problem. If he wants to add a green powder in addition to a good whole foods diet, I don't have a problem with that.
But it's not going to fix his diabetes or,
no,
you know, per se.
No, it's not going to fix the diabetes. Doug, what you have is a condition of carbohydrate intolerance. Adding more vegetables does not cure this problem. You should eat your vegetables anyway, but the main thing is to be on a good low-carb diet to take care of blood sugar.
So, you know, interesting question.
Okay. Do we have time for another?
Yep. I'll stop you in your tracks. What we generally do is we divide these podcasts into two parts, and we have about 5 minutes on this segment, and then we'll pause, and our listeners can go to part two.
All right. This comes from Frank. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, my urologist recommended I take 1,000 IU daily of vitamin E as a conservative first step way of dealing with Peyronie's disease.
Mm.
Have you ever heard of that for Peyronie's?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
Okay, so for our listening audience, what Peyronie's disease is, it's a bent penis disease. I mean, there's no other way to describe
it. There's no other way to say that.
Yeah, and it involves nodular fibrotic tissue developing in the penis, and it's a relatively common problem. Some men have this to just a mild degree, and it doesn't interfere with anything. And some men have it to the point where it makes intercourse impossible, erections painful, and they have to have, as unpleasant as it may sound, they have to have some kind of surgical treatment, literally like a penis straightening procedure, which isn't entirely, satisfactory, easy to perform. So it's a bad condition. Before there was any kind of conventional treatment for Peyronie's disease, it was recommended that, and urologists would generally suggest this, that you take high-dose vitamin E. And there are some studies, limited studies, that show that vitamin E is somewhat helpful, although vitamin E will not take a very bent penis and make it straight again, but it may slow the progression of that. Also, there's a B vitamin called PABA, which mm-hmm. is, whenever you buy B complexes, you see a B1 thiamine and B2 riboflavin and B3 niacinamide. And down the list is something called PABA or pyrimidine benzoic acid. And PABA, we don't really know too much what it does. It seems to, some people claim that it makes gray hair dark again. So it's used for that. But
that's never worked for me.
No, yeah,
I used to look for it back in the day.
Yeah, but that's kind of a not necessarily surefire remedy.
Yeah,
but it in a high dose, very high doses of PABA, far more than you get in a B complex. In fact, you have to order it as a special medication. A company called Schwartz Pharma makes Potaba, P-O-T-A-B-A, which is PABA in a powder form that you can mix in water, which tastes lousy, and you got to drink it a lot, and you have to be very obsessive about taking it because you have to take it like 4 times a day.
Yeah.
And some limited studies have shown some benefits against fibrotic conditions, particularly Peyronie's.
Oh.
However, the new thinking on this is that there is a collagenase medication that breaks collagen down that was recently approved for a hand condition of fibrosis called Dupuytren's contracture. And that's where there's a crease down the middle of your hand, like one of those fortune teller lines, except it becomes hard and it becomes contracted. And it causes the fingers to come together, and it's painful and it constrains the movement of the hand. And often that's treated with surgery, but short of surgery, you can inject collagenase into that. And I said, when that first came out, I said, gee, I bet since it's a similar thing, I bet eventually they're going to transfer the use of that to Peyronie's disease, and they have so far. I don't think it's quite been demonstrated that that is perfectly effective therapy, but it's one of the options that are available to men who have Peyronie's disease.
Interesting. Frank also wants to know what kind of tocopherols, tocotrienols, you should have a mixture.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be just the alpha tocopherol. We want a mixture of all the tocopherols and tocotrienols. That would be the best thing.
And this is actually a basis of a feature I did this last week. If you want to go to listen to the podcast, it's at drhoffman.com, where I talked about some studies of vitamin E. And around, it must have been like 2011 or so, 2010, some studies started coming out saying, hey, vitamin E isn't that good for the heart. And, it doesn't really prevent cancer. And, oh, by the way, it could be harmful. And the problem with those studies, they're all based on alpha tocopherol.
Mm-hmm.
And these authors then began studying gamma tocopherol and delta tocopherol. And what they found was those definitely are cancer preventive. And so, we actually now feature a vitamin E that's rich in gamma tocopherol. It's got some alpha, it's got some delta, and but it's a mixed tocopherol, as pretty close to what you find in nature when you eat an avocado or you have nuts or whole grains that are rich in vitamin E.
Very good. Best of luck to Frank.
Yeah, it's okay. an it's a it's a really nasty problem. And, yeah. You know, it's like one of those things where, you know, gets you where you live. You know, it's really like, I mean, it's just so disheartening to experience that kind of problem for men. And, of course, we're looking for solutions, preferably natural solutions. And, you know, vitamin E and TABA, they're possibilities. They could possibly help that. You know, also some evidence that perhaps something like MSM could have an impact on that.
Wow. What about systemic enzymes?
And, you know, that's great. That's a really good thought. And I bet you that in Europe, where the use of products like Wobenzyme, popular, that this has been applied to that condition. So that makes a lot of sense. And that could be part of an approach. You know, but you'd have to take, again, fairly high doses, maybe 3 or 4 Wobenzymes 3 or 4 times daily away from food. But that could work away at whatever fibrotic process is causing the hardening of the tissue.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a much better idea than all that TABA.
Yeah, I think that's passe. I mean, I have to say that this is a therapy that we used even way back in the 80s. I'm not even sure that this product is on the market anymore because it was based on some small studies, but it was really challenging for patients to take that much of the stuff. And it was expensive. It was not covered by insurance. So, and you'd have to take it for a long time. So I think patients were easily discouraged.
All right.
This is a good inflection point for us to pause. And let's stipulate this is part one of today's Q&A with Layla. We've answered several of your questions. We will continue to do so in part two. And Layla, give us a preview of what we're going to tackle.
Intracellular mineral deficiencies.
Oh, okay.
How are they diagnosed and treated?
Wow, okay. And?
And then, after a 9-mile run and perspiring heavily, what nutrients do we need to replace?
That's the guy's a fortunate problem. He's able to do a 9-mile run.
That's
a good problem to have.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we return, more of Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today's guest, Layla Mudin, Hoffman Center nutritionist. We'll be right back.